I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Mara Liasson has spent decades covering the happenings in Washington as an NPR national political correspondent. She must still love doing it because, as she said, I basically want to do this till I'm carried out feet first. This hour, we'll learn what led Liasson to become a journalist and how she's honed her craft, from her days as a college history major to covering seven presidential elections. We'll trace a path that's earned her many accolades. She'll give us a rundown of what a typical day is like for her. I'll ask what the current political atmosphere means for our democratic institutions. And, of course, how she plans to cover the 2020 election. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Mara Liasson is a perpetual motion machine these days as she keeps track of all their ongoing drama in Washington, and there's been a lot of it. Mara Liasson joins us this morning from the NPR booth at the White House, and we thought we'd take this opportunity to learn, you know, a little more about one of the network's most familiar voices. Mara, thanks again for taking some time to visit with us.
Thanks for having me. I've been on before, haven't I?
You sure have, and we've enjoyed it every time, Mara. Yes. I was actually out in your neck of the woods last fall. We sat in your studio
there. Right, I remember that. That's what was confusing, because, I wasn't in Kansas.
You're hearing me in five places at once. It's very confusing, yeah. Well, you joined NPR back in 1985. How did you wind up there?
I was just out of grade school. No,
weren't we all?
Yes, weren't we all? The way I ended up at NPR is I was working for public radio in California. There was something way back when called California Public Radio, and it was state-funded. Believe it or not, back in the early 80s, California had its own version, statewide version of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It was called the California Public Broadcasting Commission. And we had our own nightly news show called California Edition. It was a miniature, all things considered, 15 minutes, but same format, 5 minutes of hard news and then features and interviews. And I was kind of the host, producer, reporter, bottle washer, and janitor for that. And then when Governor Duke Majan, a Republican, was elected in 1982, he line item vetoed the California Public Broadcasting Commission, and we went off the air within 24 hours. So for the next year or so, almost 2 years, I think, I freelanced for many different people, including NPR. And then in 1985, I was hired to be a newscaster on Morning Edition, which I did for almost 2 years. Then I was a newscaster for All Things Considered. I was a general assignment reporter. I ended up covering Congress with Cokie Roberts. I was assigned to Bill Clinton to cover his presidential race in 92. I became the White House correspondent after he won. And then when he left office, I became the national political correspondent in 2000, which I have been since then. Although I am also part of the White House rotation, that's why I'm here sitting in the White House talking to you.
You know, when you first arrived at the network, you were hardly the first woman to work at NPR.
No, certainly not.
Yeah, who was already ensconced when you arrived?
I was the second generation of NPR women.
Right.
Cokie Roberts, Nina Totenberg, Susan Stamberg, Linda Wertheimer, they were all there. They were the founding mothers of NPR. And I benefited from their help, experience, mentorship. You name it. So I certainly was not a pioneer.
That group had a bunch of nicknames attached to them,
didn't
they?
Yes, the Fallopian Clown.
Yeah, I love that.
Yes.
Yes.
That was an internal nickname.
Okay. You said it, not me.
You've remarked, but you fished for it.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. You've remarked on how unique NPR was for women journalists back in the day. Why was that?
Well, because we had all these amazing female journalists that we've just listed.
Mm-hmm.
And also NPR really benefited. This sounds a little weird, but because we paid less than the networks, we got a lot of women and they stayed. A lot of times when men had families, they needed to make more money and they would go to the networks. But that isn't true anymore. We're completely competitive salary-wise now. But back then, the fact that NPR was kind of marginal and less established than the other mainstream media meant that we had a lot of women. It's just like public school teachers. You know, why were they all women before women were able to compete in professions like law and medicine and business? I mean, that's just the way it was.
You know, a few years prior to all this. You earned a history degree at Brown University. There, you were influenced by a history professor named John Thomas.
Who Ooh, was? You've done your research.
There you go. There you go. Who was John Thomas?
Oh, and, I loved him so much.
Yes.
He was a wonderful, wonderful human being, a great American history professor. He won the Bancroft Prize. I know that. You'd have to look up what year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he wrote it. The book that won was something about a populist politician. I don't think it was Henry George, but you'd really have to look that up. Anyway, he was a wonderful person. And I took a number of classes with him. I had to talk my way into the first one because it was for upperclassmen, but I kind of wouldn't go away. So he let me in. And then I wrote my honors thesis with him when I was a senior on the Federal Writers Project. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful human being and died too young.
So speaking of writing, where did you learn then how to write like a journalist?
Oh, I think just on the job.
Wow.
I mean, I can't think of how I didn't go to journalism school. And when I started working in public radio, and before I worked for California Public Radio, I actually volunteered at KPFA, which was a Pacifica station in Berkeley. That's how I learned the basic skills, how to cut tape with a razor blade. Of course, we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And how to write for, how to write for broadcast. And I guess that's how I learned. I just learned on the job, which, by the way, the vast majority of journalists learned that way, too.
I'm visiting with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson about the early days of her career. You know, who was the first big news personality that you ever interviewed? I mean, do you remember and what you learned from it? Am I going?
Oh, the very first one. I would really have to think about that. Oh, okay. Dianne Feinstein when she was the mayor of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago. But
were you nervous?
She was on the. Pardon?
Were you nervous?
You know, I can't remember if I was nervous. I do remember that I interviewed her standing up, and she and I are about the same size,
mm-hmm.
which means tall for women. And she, of course, ascended to the mayor's position in tragedy because Harvey Milk, was the mayor, was assassinated. He was openly gay. Mayor, gay activist who was on the city council and then the mayor. Mm-hmm. I guess that was the first one. I have interviewed Bill Clinton. I guess Dianne Feinstein was the first big person, public figure I interviewed.
You know, why did you wind up gravitating towards politics as much as you have? What was it about the pull of politics that grabbed you so hard?
Well, I was an American history major. I was always interested in politics and current events. Politics is the nonviolent way we work out our differences.
Mm-hmm.
And after all these years, I've never become cynical about politics. There's a lot to make you cynical or even disgusted. But I've never become that. I think it's really important. I think that people participating in the political system is the bedrock of our democracy. And I just feel it's extremely important. I feel it's important that people be informed, which I think is what NPR tries to do every day. And that kind of led me there, and I've never had a second thought about it.
Is there anything other than politics you'd like to cover?
History. Anything other than politics? Well, governance, legislation. Mm-hmm. Congress and the White House. Now over the years, I'm really interested in foreign policy, especially because the 70-year-old foreign policy consensus in the United States has broken down. You know, we have a president, first president ever, who has departed from this 70-year consensus about America's role in the world, America as a leader of democratic nations, a promoter of democratic values. That shift has been so profound that now I'm really interested in foreign policy, too.
I was going to say, how has covering President Trump altered the game for political reporters like you?
Altered the game. Well, look, you cover every president the same. He tweets instead of mm-hmm. issues official statements. So tweets are official statements. He's very accessible. you generally know what he's thinking and feeling within seconds of him thinking and feeling it, because he either tells you on the South Lawn or he tweets about it. I guess the difference with Trump, as opposed to other presidents, is usually with other presidents, what they say is the result of a policy process where they've considered the pros and cons and they come out with a policy or a statement or an opinion that they stick to. Donald Trump is very impulsive, very mercurial. He kind of makes it up as he goes along. So just because he says something one day doesn't mean that that's going to be the policy of the United States the next day.
And his supporters seem okay with that. And it's such a departure from past presidencies. Why can he get away with it?
Well, politics has become so polarized and tribalized, mm-hmm. and some people have even called the Republican Party now a cult of personality because it's all about Donald Trump. It's mm-hmm. really not about the principles that have guided the Republican Party for generations: small government, leadership in the world, conservative social issues. He has some of that, and he's governed in some ways like a traditional Republican president would. But why can he get away with that? First of all, getting away with that is a term of art. Mm-hmm. He has never been above 50% approval ratings. He's okay. The first president who has never achieved that in his first 2 years. And we'll see, although he is a favorite for re-election, I would say, based on history and the economy and a whole bunch of other things I could talk about. Mm-hmm. I think he is a favorite for re-election. He is not in the position that other presidents have been in with such a good economy. So I guess I would argue with how much he's gotten away with it. In other words, just as his supporters thrill to his every utterance, he also energizes his opponents, and they are very energized.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's all this concern. You know, Trump often talks about fake news. The president does. How should listeners guard themselves against the influence of fake news?
Well, there's two different definitions of fake news. The traditional definition is fake news is news that's fake. It's false. It's mm-hmm. propaganda. There's lots of ways that listeners can learn to tell the difference between false news, fake news, and news that's based on fact and evidence, which is they have to find out what the sources of news articles are, where they're getting them. Are they just getting it in their Facebook news feed, or they're from their Facebook friends group? They have to learn how to evaluate news sources, news organizations, which ones are credible, which ones are just partisan. I would hope that there will be a revival of K-12 civics education, a real curriculum, strong, rigorous curriculum.
You talk about that a lot, Mara.
Yeah, because I think that part of that curriculum would be not just learning about what democracy is, what a democratic republic is, what our institutions are, what they're supposed to be, what democratic values are, what democratic norms are, but also how to be an informed consumer of news at a time when the opportunity to spread false information has never been bigger or easier because of the internet. I would hope that curriculum would also include financial literacy. People are graduating from high school. They have no idea what a mortgage is. They don't know how a credit card works. They have no idea the difference between what they pay in taxes in their particular community or state and what they get back from the federal government. That there are things people can do. Now, there's another definition of fake news, which is the way Donald Trump uses it, which is mm-hmm. news that I don't like.
Right.
News that's negative about me. So that's really two different things.
Our guest today is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. She's one of the most highly respected voices in American political journalism. Mara, we talked in our last segment about why you find covering politics so vital, so important. But you've said that you want to continue covering politics until I'm carried out feet first.
Oh, my goodness. I said that?
Yes, you did. I can show you the clip.
Okay. I believe you. I have to reconsider that. Yeah.
What's a tougher assignment for you, doing one of these live two-way conversations with an NPR host like Steve Inskeep, or doing a more conventional story?
I don't think either of them is harder. They're just really different.
Mm-hmm.
Preparing for what we call a two-way, a conversation with a host, you're doing the same reporting. The difference is that if you're preparing a produced piece, you have to make sure you can get your interviews on the record on tape, mm-hmm. which you don't have to do if you're just doing a two-way. Sometimes that involves going outside of Washington, which, of course, we love to do, and we don't get to do it as much as we want.
Mm-hmm.
It's just different. A reported piece is a little more leisurely. You go out, you collect your interviews, you write them, write the story, you know, produce it. A two-way is like, hey, guess what? You're on the air in an hour.
And do you, do a two-way in part because you can say things based on what your sources are telling you that maybe they won't say on tape?
Sometimes that's mm-hmm. part of it. But a lot of times the reason why we do two ways over pieces is that we either it's a faster way for us to respond to the news. I mean, something breaks at 2 o'clock. We're going to do a two way at four. We're not going to be able to do a rigorously in-depth reported piece
right.
with lots of tape in
right.
that period of time.
You know, I want to take advantage of the perspective you have as someone who's now covered various aspects of so many different administrations. Which administration was the most transparent about why it does what it does?
Which was the most transparent? Well, the only administrations I've covered on a day-to-day basis as a White House reporter was Clinton and Obama. During mm-hmm. George W., I was the political reporter. I came back into the White House rotation still as the political correspondent, but I came back into the White House rotation during Obama. I would say clearly the Trump administration is the least transparent. The most transparent, probably Clinton.
Hmm.
He was a policy wonk. He was very garrulous. He liked to talk to people and explain things. His administration was fairly open. I think that Barack Obama was just a more buttoned-down kind of operation.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't untransparent. You know, they explained what they were doing. They had many, many opportunities to interact with the press. I guess I'd just say that Trump is the least transparent. Now, some of that is that there is no policy process, per se, in the Trump White House. It's pretty much Donald Trump figuring out what he wants to do. Sometimes he announces something and his White House has to scramble to backfill it to figure out what he meant and how they're going to make it happen. And sometimes it's hard. He wants the border closed. And as we've seen in the last couple of days, it's hard to figure out what you can do legally to get that done.
You know, as a White House correspondent for NPR, as a national political correspondent, are you invited to, I'm just imagining, off-the-record sit-downs with the leader of the free world where these cases will tell you what's going on?
Generally, there are he's mostly on the record with the press, and there are many—I have interacted with him many times. I have occasionally been off the record with him, particularly on Air Force One. Comes back, chats, some of it's on the record,
this
some of
President
it's
President Trump you're talking
President
about.
President Trump, yes. The other presidents, I think— the only off-the-record times that I can think of are on Air Force One. Sometimes Donald Trump will do off-the-record with the television anchors before the State of the Union or a big event. Generally, presidents do not have a lot of off-the-record events with the press. Although Donald Trump, for sure, he talks, I don't know if you want to call them journalists, but he talks to Sean Hannity all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He has called other reporters and talked to them off the record, sometimes on the record. He's very accessible. That's not the issue with Donald Trump. He believes that he's his own best communications director. And that's one of the reasons there are no more White House briefings, because
yeah.
he feels he can communicate his message most effectively by himself.
Which administration leaked the most, meaning you had insiders calling you with some regularity with stories?
Definitely Bill Clinton.
Because why?
Because it was a loose, chaotic operation. Every White House reflects the personality of the president.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama wasn't called No Drama Obama for nothing. He was very cerebral, very buttoned down. There was an orderly process. Everyone in the White House liked each other. So there wasn't as much leaking. This White House leaks a lot. I still think the Clinton White House leaked the most. But this White House leaks a lot, mostly because everyone is at loggerheads with each other and there's so much mistrust. And people are miserable.
Which administration faced the greatest crisis, whether it was domestic or international? Was there a moment that maybe even you were a little unnerved?
Well, definitely George W. Bush faced the biggest crisis in recent memory, 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that goes without saying.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt that was the biggest crisis. Now, Barack Obama faced a financial crisis,
right.
You know, and so he inherited the worst economic situation since the Great Depression. But I would say George W. Bush clearly had to deal with the most the biggest crisis ever. The United States was attacked for the first time since Pearl Harbor like that.
I'm Steve Kraske, and I'm visiting today with Mara Liasson, who's a national political correspondent for NPR. You hear her voice frequently each week here at KCUR. Mara, what's a day in your work life look like? I mean, when does it start? How do you navigate your way through a day?
It never ends. I guess in the morning you wake up and you see if Donald Trump has tweeted anything. Mm-hmm. And then depending on what your day is like, some days if I'm on up first, I wake up at 4:30 and I'm on the air at 5 and then again at 7. And then I make phone calls and maybe I'm on a podcast, but then I pretty much wrap up in the early afternoon. If it's a regular day, I either come to headquarters, NPR's beautiful new headquarters, mm-hmm. or I go to the White House if it's my day at the White House. We take turns because only one of us is in the booth at the White House at a time. The booth is very small. And then if I'm at the White House, it's my job to cover the daily news of what's happening. Tonight I'll be on All Things Considered talking about Kirstjen Nielsen's resignation. Or I'm working on a longer range piece, which I always have one. Like I'm working on one right now about the Republicans or the Trump campaign's theory of the case, how he's going to win in 2020. So I was over at Trump headquarters the other day, and I'll be doing some interviews, and then I'll put a piece together. So you always have some longer-range thing you're working on in between mm-hmm. doing whatever daily reporting you have to do.
Yeah, I was wondering how much time you spend on the Hill, how much time you spend at the White House. How is it divided up?
Oh, well, I'm either at headquarters or at the White House, okay. or I'm going around and doing interviews. I might go up to the Hill to do an interview, but mm-hmm. I'm not on the Hill reporting on the Hill. Those are our congressional reporters do that.
You know, you have said that these days all of our democratic institutions are undergoing a kind of stress test. What did you mean by that?
I think that the president has a very different view of democratic institutions than any other president. The founding fathers were kind of geniuses, and they didn't trust anyone. They knew that power corrupts, so they set up this very frustrating system of checks and balances, independent institutions, judiciary, legislative branch, executive branch, and all of those institutions were supposed to check each other so that no one would become all-powerful. The founders didn't want a king. They didn't want a king parliament, and they didn't want what they would have called a star chamber court. So Donald Trump seems to think that he should order the Justice Department, which is supposed to be independent, to sometimes he has told them to go and prosecute his political enemies. You know, lock her up was a chant that mm-hmm. that was really his most famous one on the campaign, and it continues to this day. His supporters at rallies talk about putting Hillary Clinton in jail. So what I mean by a stress test, or for instance, he's attacked individual members of the judiciary, judges, the judge who had Mexican parents, who mm-hmm. Donald Trump said because of his Mexican heritage, this judge could not judge the Trump University case impartially, you know, or now he believes that he wants to do certain things at the border that are prohibited by law or shutting down the government or declaring a national emergency. So he's constantly testing the limits of what a president can do. And what I mean by a stress test is if you look at the democratic institutions in America to see how they're holding up, I would say so far they're holding up. For instance, the judiciary is still independent. Mm-hmm. Judges are ruling against the Trump administration. If we were not in a democratic republic with democratic independent institutions, they wouldn't do that. Under authoritarian governments, the government doesn't go to court and loses. In America, the government can go to court and loses, like it did in the AT&T Time Warner mm-hmm. Merger case. So I would say the independent judiciary holding up pretty well. The press, okay? We have an independent press, and of course we're attacked on almost a daily basis by the president. Fake news, enemy of the people. He's talked about opening up the libel laws. And we're under tremendous pressure. And I think that the mainstream news organizations, among them are NPR, are still trying to do fact-based, evidence-based reporting. So I would say we're holding up pretty well. Congress, You know, the voters decided to put a check and balance on Donald Trump. They chose to have divided government, and they put Democrats in charge of the House. And now they are doing their oversight against the on the executive branch, which is normal. It's a normal function in a democratic republic. Whether they will be perceived by the voters as having gone too far or not remains to be seen. And then there are the citizens, which are the most important democratic institution that we've got in the United States. And I would say they're doing pretty well. They vote in large numbers. We've had the highest turnout midterm election since 1914. And I mean Republicans and Democrats turning out in high numbers. That's a good thing. They also organized. People went to town hall meetings. They worked for their candidates. I always say the last midterm was a real League of Women Voters midterm. It wasn't an SDS midterm. It wasn't like we didn't have a lot of demonstrations in the streets. We had people working hard going door to door for their candidates. That's a great thing. And that shows that democratic institutions, for the most part, are handling the stress test pretty well.
You know, you've been part of NPR's coverage of seven presidential elections, and you're staring down the barrel of an eighth now. What's going to be the challenge of covering a Democratic primary race with so many candidates?
It's going to be a real challenge because you want to give every candidate a fair shot. And you also want to hold candidates to the same standard. That was one of the criticisms of 2016, that many people felt that Donald Trump was not held to the same standard of scrutiny as Hillary Clinton was. Just an example, people think that some of the candidates, some of the female candidates are not getting as much attention as the male candidates. And there was a little mini kind of controversy about Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who talked about democracy and capitalism going hand in hand. And he was saying you can't have capitalism without democracy. If you do, you end up with Russia. You end up with a kleptocracy, crony capitalism. And people pointed out, hey, wait a minute. Elizabeth Warren has been saying that same exact thing for years. And how come all of a sudden he's getting all this attention? Well, he's getting all this attention because he's the fresh, new, young face that people are enamored with. But that's something that we have to guard against. You know, are we giving everybody fair coverage? Now, you're not going to give the guy at 1% in the polls the same amount of coverage as you're going to get somebody who's the somebody who's the front runner. But you try to guard against that.
That's Mara Liasson. Mara, always appreciate your time. Thanks for taking it with us
Thank
today.
You.